The IHRC has been organising the UK Kids Day demonstrations now for many years. I mean, how did your involvement start and how's this developed? How's it developed over the years?
Well, I've personally been involved in organising and helping to organise Al-Quds Day even prior to establishment of IHRC. The fact of the matter is that the Al-Quds Day is significant because it was the first international day of solidarity with Palestinians. Long before the sort of Nakba Day and so forth being established. And it was a Muslim platform to be shared with everyone else to stand up in solidarity with the Palestinian and really brought a huge change within the Muslim world in rallying support for the Palestinians, and it continues now, and that's why it's being targeted day in, day out. That's why the sort of unholy marriages between the extreme right and the sort of racist and Zionists and everybody else, it really is a testimony to the sort of diversity of the group of people that come together from the Jewish, from the Christian, from the atheists, you know, really people coming together.
David, I wonder if we could just turn now to the case against Nazim Ali. I mean, it's dragged on and on and on, hasn't it? I mean, is that unusual?
It's quite unusual, but it's part of the modus operandi of the Zionists, isn't it? They try and, in many other cases too, try and tie people up in a case, and then when they lose that case, they go on to take another action, and then another action, and another action. This case has been before his professional body. It's been before the supervisory body of the professional body. It's been before the High Court. It's been sent back to the supervisory body in the first place, and we still haven't got any kind of resolution of it. It's been going dragging on for years and years. But you know, not unusual in the sense that that's what the Zionists try and do. They try and gummy you up in procedure so that you spend, you know, like, literally a significant proportion of your life fighting something which should never have been an issue in the first place.
No, indeed. I mean, and Masood, I wonder whether you know you could tell us a bit more about the case of Nazim Ali, because you know, obviously it's still ongoing, isn't it?
Well, David is absolutely right. I mean, the tactic is to sort of damage individuals to the extent that nobody else will support the Palestinian cause and to silence anyone who will stand and support the genuine need of the Palestinian. Now, what they did regarding Nazim, first of all, they target the police. Number of times for them to prosecute, they refuse on every level. 3 or 4 intervention and they failed. Then they targeted the public prosecutors several times. They refused to take part. Then they took the matter into civil court, and then public prosecutors got in and stopped it. So then they took it to the professional body, and then they lost. I mean, every stage they have actually lost, but they have persisted using any means to pressurize and demonize and create a precedent so no one else will dare to challenge them. Now, what has happened now, the last stage, is that they argued that the way that the professional body dealt with it, it was unacceptable because they actually they took it into area of intention and so forth. They're saying that should not be taken into account. It should not be taken into account in the decision-making. So it's gone back. But in the same time, when they are dealing with their own supporters, we had the case in Scotland, a teacher acted and that is anti-Semite and start sending anti-Semite material out on public arena. Then he was found and then was taken into court. They argued, the same people are saying that the intention and so forth should not be taken into account. They argued that the intention has to be taken into account. So they are really just making a mockery of any principle. No. The only principle they are upholding is that no one should defend Palestinians yeah. or attack Israelis. To do so is anti-Semite, and it needs to be fought on every level. That is the only principle. In their eyes, there is no good pro-Palestinian. No.
David, would it be fair to say that there's a variety of groups that are trying to suppress Quds Day?
Certainly. I mean, of course, first of all, there's the alliance between the far-right, pro-Shah of Iran supporters, and the Zionists. But within the Zionist movement, there are literally tens of different Zionist organisations. You saw in the video there a whole list of Zionist organisations, almost all of which have got direct connections to the Israeli government itself, and most importantly in terms of the organisations there, UK Lawyers for Israel and the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, both of which, you know, direct connections to the State of Israel, the UK LFI was effectively set up by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the CAA funded to a large extent by
Campaign Against Anti-Semitism
by the Jewish National Fund, which of course is the main land-grabbing agency in occupied Palestine. So, wide range of organisations.
Well, we're just going to pause there for a moment because we've got another report now on the efforts being made to suppress Quds Day because of its growing success.
Quds Day is a global celebration of the Palestinian resistance and the ardent desire of the mass of the world's population for the full liberation of Palestine. It was inaugurated by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini shortly after the Islamic Revolution as a response to Jerusalem Day, in which Jewish settlers rampage around Al-Quds, which they call Jerusalem, chanting racist slogans including, "May your village burn." In 1979, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "For many years I've been notifying the Muslims of the danger posed by the usurper Israel. I ask all the Muslims of the world and the Muslim governments to join together to sever the hand of this usurper and its supporters," and through a ceremony demonstrating the solidarity of Muslims worldwide, announced their support for the legitimate rights of the Muslim people. The day is also marked throughout Muslim and Arab countries, in over 80 Islamic and non-Islamic countries in total. In the West, these include the United States of America, Canada, Australia, Germany, Spain, the United Kingdom, France, and Greece. As a result, the Muslim unity displayed in Quds Day is a threat to the Zionist entity and its supporters and assets in the West and elsewhere. Accordingly, they mobilized to smear and denounce Quds Day and to claim that its celebration exhibits extremism and anti-Semitism. In the UK, Zionist groups have been attempting to sabotage the celebration for more than 15 years. In the US, Zionist entity assets have gone on the offensive. The Anti-Defamation League, which is an extension of the Zionist regime's intelligence apparatus in the US, denounced Quds Day in 2016 as, quote, "a hateful demonstration of anti-Israel and anti-Semitic sentiment." In 2022, it labeled calls for the dismantling of Zionism, quite fancifully, as genocidal ambitions. In Germany, Bundesamt für Verfassungsschutz, or Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution in English, is the domestic intelligence agency. In 2019, it published a deeply racist report on anti-Semitism and Islamist extremism. It specifically singled out Quds Day and denounced a huge range of Muslim political groups as extreme. All were labeled with the Zionist-created notion of Islamic anti-Semitism. The report openly states that German intelligence spies on peaceful and legal Muslim activists, so long as they are defined as Islamist, a racist term which effectively covers any Muslim active in politics. The temporary Zionist entity continues its onslaught of ethnic cleansing and murder. But this year, the celebration of Quds Day go ahead, and in a situation more advantageous for the Palestinians than in many years.
David, do you think you can compare Quds Day with Jerusalem Day?
Well, you can compare them, and it's not a very nice comparison. I mean, Quds Day is about suggesting that we liberate Palestine, that we end the occupation by the Zionists. And for Jerusalem Day, it's a celebration of racist hate. I mean, the the death to the Arabs, which is routinely heard. May your village burn. A second Nakba is coming. This is a vile racism on this naked display in the streets of Jerusalem. Whereas in Quds Day, what we see is the possibility of the ending of the occupation, of the ending of this kind of racism. So, yes, of course, you can compare them, but it's not a very good comparison.
Chalk and cheese, really, then. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Masoud, what would you say is the worldwide significance of Quds Day? I mean, do you think it helps to bridge the divide in the Muslim world?
Well, it does. I mean, it has mobilized the masses in the Muslim world when we have seen, unfortunately, some Muslim leaders are involved in normalization. But indeed, the masses have been involved and has been mobilized. And we saw in World Cup how masses of Muslims are so committed. That is part of this ongoing awareness of what's going on. And in the non-Muslim world, the way that Muslims, Jews, Christians, atheists, everyone has come together, it actually is a credit, to everyone. And it's something that needs to be celebrated. And I actually think that, last year on Al-Quds Day, Professor Haim said something very fundamental. He said he's an atheist. He's completely believes in atheism. But what he has studied in history, the only time that Muslims, Christians, and Jews have managed to live together has been under Muslim rule. And I think that's a factual thing. Sure. Yeah. And he was actually praising that the Muslims are committed to this. Yes. And I think what we are doing, what we're coming together to articulate that.
Yes.
We want to end of apartheid, we want end of occupation, because we want to live together.
Yeah, yes, indeed. The World Cup was really inspirational. I mean, although Palestine wasn't sort of competing in the World Cup finals, they were the big winners, it seems to me, and everybody seemed united right across the piece in support for Palestine. It was fantastic. But David, the video we've mentioned, a German intelligence report, didn't it? And it seemed pretty extraordinary to me, I've got to say. I mean, to what extent do you think it expresses Zionist assumptions?
Well, it's very much expresses Zionist assumptions. Even the idea of Islamism is something which, a term which is originated by Zionist ideologues in the 1980s, after 1979, after the Islamic Revolution.
Indeed.
And also the idea of Islamic anti-Semitism, a concept which wasn't known in the world 30 years ago or so, has been invented again by the Zionists. And here we see, effectively, it could have been written by an Israel lobby group, but it's actually written by the German internal intelligence organization. So, again, another instance where Zionist assumptions have totally penetrated the country of Germany through internal intelligence system. Just like that has been the case in a number of other Western countries. But we've seen in the show before the particular role that Germany has played in supporting Zionism as a result of its misplaced guilt for the Second World War, thinking that what they've got to do is to support Israel as opposed to the guilt that they have for the assault on the Jews. These are a set of Zionist assumptions which need to be removed, because otherwise we're never going to have the possibility of a proper support for democracy in Palestine.
Yes, indeed. Support Jewish people by pressing the Palestinians doesn't sound like a fair deal to me at all. But Masoud, I mean, you chair the Islamic Human Rights Commission, as I was saying in the introduction there, and you've been consistently targeted, haven't you, by Zionists over the years. I mean, tell us a bit about that. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
It's a badge of honour, really. I think, I remember in my youth being targeted by the apartheid South Africa. It was a badge of honour.
Yes.
It is a badge of honour now to be targeted. And actually, I think we need to give the confidence to our community that if you're not being targeted by the last apartheid system in the world, then there is something wrong.
Yes.
You can't be a human rights activist and activist for a better world if you're not targeted.
Yeah.
But the problem is this, that they're systematically doing it, as they've done it to David, as they've done it to Nazim, as they've done it to Reverend Sizer, as they've done it to Jeremy. I mean, Jeremy hasn't got a ounce of racism in him. We all know him.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been victimised by them too.
Well, exactly. but I think we all should worry with the badge of honour. Actually, I think we need to sort of say that those who haven't been targeted, who are claiming to speak for justice and inclusive society, then they have to explain why.
Sure. Yeah. David, just remind us, will you, about the Anti-Defamation League and its relationship with the FBI and Mossad.
So the Anti-Defamation League has been in existence for over a century now. And it was set up to contest the defamation of the Jewish people. But from very early on, within a couple of decades of its creation, it started to spy on Arab Americans, people who were involved in the campaign to prevent the creation of the State of Israel. And from 1948 onwards, it intensified its spying, very closely working with the FBI, spying on Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans, and Arab Americans. And, of course, in 1993, the big scandal erupted where it was shown that it had been passing a spy information that it gleaned from its spying operations, closely working with the FBI, onto BOS, the South African Apartheid Intelligence Organization, including passing them information for money. So there's a really very long relationship between the ADL and spy agencies. And, of course, in fact, what it's been doing as part of this process has been operating as a kind of wing of the Israeli intelligence apparatus in the US.
And just finally, and briefly, because we're almost out of time, Masood, I mean, why do you think they should join the Quds demonstration in London on April the 16th?
I think we should join them basically because we support a just cause. Yeah. And that just cause needs to have champions. And we need to rise up to that challenge. But we should also stand and realize that it is effective. The reason that the Zionists are putting so much effort in trying to stop it is because it's effective and it will bring confidence to all of us to stand together, because standing together is more important.
Unity is strength. Come and help spike the guns of the Zionist lobby, I think is Masood's message. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to our guests, Masood Sajara, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Make a date in your diary to tune in to next week's episode of Palestine Declassified, when we'll be back with more investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "The Lord Most High has chosen for us certain followers, Shiites, who assist us. If we are joyful, they are joyful. And if we are sorrowful and sad, they are sorrowful and sad."
in the limelight.
When the term de-dollarization was coined, there was a concrete idea behind it, that the U.S. currency would be uncrowned someday. And when we talk about the U.S. decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and the end of dollar hegemony in the world. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar as world economies are exhausted by the U.S. military and financial bullying. So, efforts are underway to topple the dollar. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the website of People Dispatch, a senior Russian official indicated that a new currency project might be announced at the upcoming BRICS summit in South Africa. The alliance's other members, including Brazil, China, Russia, and India, have already taken steps to bypass the U.S.-dominated global trade and finance system. Speaking recently on the sidelines of the Russian-Indian Strategic Partnership for Development and Growth Business Forum in Indian capital New Delhi, the deputy chairman of Russian State Duma, Alexander Bobakov, announced that BRICS states including Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa were working towards the creation of a new currency. The bloc's members have made key moves away from the U.S.-dominated international trade and financial system. The transition to settlements in national currencies is the first step. The next one is to provide the circulation of digital or any other form of a fundamentally new currency in the near future, Bobakov said. He further claimed that readiness to realize this project will be indicated at the upcoming BRICS summit, be held in August in Durban, South Africa. While further details of this landmark project are yet to be fully revealed, it is already clear that its scope will be significant. The current BRICS countries already account for 40% of the global population and one-fourth of the global GDP. The alliance is now set to expand with Iran and Saudi Arabia, having initiated the formal process to join. Over 10 other countries, including Egypt, Algeria, the UAE, Mexico, Argentina, and Nigeria, have also expressed interest in joining the bloc. Bobakov added that the new currency would be based on a strategy that does not defend the dollar or euro and will be pegged to the value of not just gold but also other groups of products, rare earth minerals or soil. The first part of this process, namely trade in national currencies, is already well underway. On March 29th, China and Brazil, the world's second largest economy and Latin America's biggest economy respectively, announced that they will conduct bilateral trade in their local currencies, the Chinese yuan and the Brazilian reais, bypassing the U.S. dollar. China is Brazil's biggest trade partner, with bilateral trade reaching $150 billion in 2022. China's currency, the renminbi, has also become Brazil's second largest international reserve currency. While the creation of an alternative system to counter dollar dominance or, more broadly, monetary cooperation in the face of U.S. dominance had been discussed among the BRICS states for years, the blanket sanctions imposed on Russia by the U.S. and its allies gave further impetus for countries to move in this direction. both Russia and China have reaffirmed their commitment to advancing bilateral trade in their national currencies, and this was reiterated at their joint summit in March. Russian President Vladimir Putin said we should continue promoting settlements in national currencies and expand the reciprocal presence of financial and banking structures in our country's markets. At this stage, two-thirds of payments under trade deals between our countries are made in rubles and yuan. He also highlighted that trade between Russia and China had increased by over 30% in the past year and was expected to reach $200 billion in 2023. Putin also expressed support for the use of the Chinese yuan in transactions between Russia and its partners in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where China is already the largest trade partner for many of the countries. The growing trend towards seeking alternatives to reduce dollar dependence, including trade in local currencies, is also being deliberated upon by regional organizations, including the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Earlier this year, Brazil and Argentina also proposed to work towards creating a common currency called SOR to enhance regional trade and financial exchanges while reducing reliance on the US dollar. Not only is the BRICS bloc seeking to move away from de-dollarization in matters of trade and finance, it has also attempted to provide an alternative to the U.S.-dominated Bretton Woods institutions, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank in the form of the New Development Bank, NDB. At present, aside from the five BRICS countries, Egypt, the UAE, and Bangladesh are also members of the NDB. One of the reasons to set up the NDB, South Africa's foreign minister Naledi Pandor told Sputnik, was to seek an alternative to the dollar-based payments architecture. The systems currently in the place tend to privilege very wealthy countries and tend to be really a challenge for countries such as ourselves, which have to make payments in dollars, which costs more in terms of various currencies, he said. The website of Mint also noted President Vladimir Putin adopted a new foreign policy identifying China and India as its main allies on the world stage. Now the ties between the three nations and a few others appear poised to go a step further with the formation of a new currency. According to reports quoting Russian lawmaker Alexander Babakov, the BRICS nations are in the process of creating a new medium for payments established on a strategy that does not defend the dollar or euro. He reportedly indicated that the new currency would be secured by gold and other commodities, such as the rare earth elements. While the claim is yet to be verified by other officials from the member nations, it came mere days before South Africa sent senior officials to Russia to discuss recalibration of the global order with President Putin's party. The country is also slated to host a BRICS summit in August this year. Earlier, President Putin adopted a new foreign policy that put India and China at the forefront. The announcement also came mere days after Chinese Premier Xi Jinping visited Moscow to further cement the No Limits partnership announced last year. Russia will continue to build up a particularly privileged strategic partnership with the Republic of India, with a view to enhance and expand cooperation in all areas on a mutually beneficial basis and place a special emphasis on increasing the volume of bilateral trade, strengthening investment and technological ties, and ensuring their resistance to destructive actions of unfriendly states and their alliances, the statement said. It also announced its intention to prioritize and enhance its capacity and international role in groupings such as BRICS to help adapt the world to the realities of a multipolar world.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we'll be having a conversation with Dr. Mohammad Javad Ladejani in order to gain insight into the historic and strategic impact of the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic. First, this brief analysis.
The Islamic Revolution overthrew more than 2,500 years of hereditary monarchy and established the first Islamic Republic under the leadership of an Islamic jurisprudent, a unique event in the history of the Islamic Ummah and in global history. The impact of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic has not been limited to Iran, and it extends to the entire Islamic world and to all of contemporary global affairs. A reality that even the enemies of the Islamic Republic are reluctantly conceding after more than 40 years of vigorous denial. The Islamic Revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic fundamentally transformed Iranian society from a semi-feudal, semi-literate, dependent dictatorship into a highly educated, technologically advanced, independent society, where all levels of government, from village councils up to the position of the leader of the revolution, are based on the direct and indirect votes of the people. It transformed a passive, uninformed, unmotivated population, used to centuries of being treated as pawns of kings and foreign powers, into an active, informed, socially conscious population with arguably the highest level of political awareness found anywhere among the peoples of the world, and which is not confined to the elites, and exists among most social classes, ages, and genders. It transformed Iran from being a tool and gendarme of America's interests in the region into the strongest regional power that aims to liberate the region from U.S. occupation, serving as the main spiritual and material support of the native population's liberation movements against foreign occupation and Western-backed dictators in the region. It transformed Iran's global geostrategic identity from being simply viewed as a massive oil field at the service of Anglo-American imperial ambitions into a significant geostrategic actor in international affairs, capable of projecting its power globally, for example, to America's self-proclaimed backyard of Latin America and beyond. It proved to the world that people can liberate themselves from the rule of Western-backed dictators and achieve breathtaking political, social, economic, and technological advancement without having to give up their national sovereignty and religious identity and values. It showed Muslims that rationalism, scientific advancement, and democratic participation are at the heart of Islam, Islamic society, and Islamic civilization, severely pressuring those Western-installed and Western-backed Arab tribal dictators and military juntas who justify their undemocratic rule with perverted interpretations of Islam. it challenged the propaganda about the inevitability and long-term sustainability of the Zionist colonial settler project called Israel, which is trying to ethnically cleanse the Palestinian people and steal their homeland with US and European support, a land that is at the heart of the Islamic Ummah and is the geostrategically most important global crossroads between Asia, Africa, and Europe. The Islamic Republic of Iran is a living, dynamic, and evolving political entity which has fundamentally affected the world in the 40-plus years of its existence so far, and it will continue to grow and become more powerful, along with the continued, well-funded Western propaganda war against it, denying realities on the ground. Indeed, whatever profound impact the Islamic Republic has had in the last four decades, it could all be considered small in comparison to the next four decades, considering the rise of Asia and what many experts have called the coming Asian century, the increasingly strategic and economic unity among Eurasian nations, as well as the increased social, economic, and technological advancement of many Islamic nations following the decolonization in the 20th century, which is leading to a rebirth of a new Islamic civilization. A new Islamic civilization whose date of rebirth might be set by future historians as the date of the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran by the Iranian people under the leadership of an Islamic jurisprudent by the name of Imam Khomeini.
We're here at the Institute of Fundamental Studies for our conversation with Dr. Larijani about the impact of the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of the Islamic Republic. This used to be the personal offices of the former queen before the revolution, a vast complex in the Niavaran section of North Tehran that after the revolution became open to the public. In the south, we have the famous Niavaran Cultural Center, and here we have the Institute of Fundamental Studies, where Dr. Larijani is the director, where sciences, basic sciences are conducted, research into basic sciences are conducted, such as astronomy, mathematics, and physics. Greetings, Dr. Larijani. Thank you for accepting our invitation to this conversation. I'm purposely using the word conversation as opposed to interview because, as you know, we spoke before, our program, Insight, tries to gain a deeper understanding of the news, tries to look at the news from a historic and strategic perspective. And inshallah, I'm hoping and I'm encouraging you to please get into the issues deeper than you would in a normal interview, in a normal Q&A. The topic that we want to talk about is the Islamic Revolution, the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Your background allows us to really look at some of the issues in terms of the theoretical discussions, in terms of some of the strategic, historic, and even implications, and even some of the implications as it relates to Islam and the world of Islam. So with that, let me begin by stating the first issue in terms of our discussion. I think it might be good. I'm suggesting that we have this conversation in three levels. We talk about the revolution and the Islamic Republic as a matter of Iranian history, and then after that we can expand that to the Ummah, Islamic civilization, and then finally we can try to analyze this issue from a global perspective as it relates to human civilization and the consequences and the impact that it had for humanity. In terms of Iran itself, obviously Iran, an ancient nation, a long, very long thousands of years of history, and we see that the revolution and the Islamic Republic basically overthrew a 2,500-year hereditary monarchy. Of course, the 2,500 years that is mentioned is maybe not scientifically very precise, but, you know, when we look at history, this is what we can, in terms of written history, we can say approximately 2,500 years of hereditary monarchy. It transformed Iran from a semi-feudal, semi-literate, dependent dictatorship into a society which today, if we look at it, is highly educated, technologically advanced. And maybe most importantly, it's a country where the people elect on all levels, from the village council to the national parliament, to the president and the administration, the government, all the way up to the leader of the Islamic Revolution, which is elected from the Assembly of Experts, which itself is directly elected by the people. These are some of the transformations that we've seen in Iran in the last 43 years. Iran has changed from being, at the best case, the gendarme of the Americans in the region and pursuing America's interest in the region, to becoming the most powerful and significant nation in West Asia, the most important strategic area in the world. And we even now have reached a point where Iran is projecting its power globally to all areas of the world. If we look at, for example, Latin America, the recent events that we have witnessed in terms of Iran supporting Venezuela and allowing Venezuela to resist the Americans. So it's a very different country than we had 43 years ago. I think the interesting question here that we should discuss, and like I said, I think you're probably one of the few people who can actually address this issue, is that some of those who are skeptical about the Islamic Republic, religion being the basis of governing a society, will come and say that all of these things would have happened anyways, even if the revolution had not been Islamic. That, you know, if so-and-so had done the revolution, if the state had been organized in a different manner, we would have had the same things. So what I would like you to please help us gain some insight into is to the significance of the Islamic aspect of the revolution and the Islamic aspect of the Islamic Republic.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Well, thank you very much for bringing this discussion about. Well, let's jump on the issue and leave the formalities.
Very good.
Revolution, Islamic revolution in 1978 was a spectacular historical event with different dimensions, domestically, regionally, internationally. Well, when right now we look at it at this time, well, it is a historical event of the past. But through this phenomenon, generated two social phenomena, the social movement, or I should say, happening, which is right now is quite alive, vigilant, and also evolving. One of them was the creation of Islamic Republic in Iran. And secondly, the second one is what Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, said, is the movement of resistance, which is beyond the border. Let's just stick to the first one. Creation of Islamic Republic of Iran, what is the real essence of that? Formally, it means, conceptually, it means to erect a polity, a social political structure, based on Islamic rationality, which adopts functional democracy, functional representational democracy, as its way of governance. To indulge in the issue more, I should say one little bit about the significance of rationality. Rationality, though it is coined with Max Weber mostly, but definitely was in our culture, especially in the teachings of Shia's teaching and tradition. Rationality means the way to justify your action.
Exactly.
A way to justify your action. So Islamic rationality means the way that we should justify our actions individual and socially. This is, when in contrast to the secular liberal rationality, which is another way of justifying your action based on other principles that you have. Well, I don't know whether time permits.
Time permits.
To go to make this comparison more.
Please, go ahead.
At this moment, let us not bog down in the issue, move a little bit ahead. The functional democracy is also an issue which a lot of thinkers, especially again Max Weber and others, have worked on that. And they said, look, democracy, we doubt that it has an intrinsic value, as some Western countries they say. It is justified based on the output.
Exactly.
So in our constitution, it is exactly like that. I mean, we have put the functionality of democracy without, going into detail or just reciting poems on supporting democracy. Very functionally, we incorporated that. So as you mentioned, all levels of this decision-making in our society is directly or indirectly supported by a kind of public concern. So through election or any other means. So we have it. We have incorporated democracy, functional democracy, which has different models, representational model. We adopted that into our constitution. So at the beginning, there were challenges. First, from external challenges, especially Americans and Western, they suffer from a malaise of egocentrism. Philosophically, they said, well, this is not possible. The best way of thinking and rationality is secular liberal system, so it is doomed to fail. Politically, they were determined to make it to fail because they thought that it is very threatful, and they thought that if this happens to work, then a lot of countries in the Islamic world, at least over a billion population, they may go toward that, and it is a big challenge. So this was an external challenge. The internal challenge we had also, it was serious, because we had an elite of Francophones and Anglophones and others, secular elite, I should call them. They were raising different doubts. I can sum up these doubts in three areas. The first one was they saying, well, Islam is antiquated, it's old-fashioned. We are living in modern time. This does not suit us. It may be it was good that is as time, but not now. The second challenge was that religion generally is for the private sphere of life. This dichotomy of private or public, which Habermas is saying that mostly we have created to push the clergy out of political love, philosophically doesn't have any base.
Which might have had a reason in the Christian world or in the European world, but why, you know, force that onto another?
Well, the demarcation, even in the Western world is not very rigorous. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. They say it, but in practice...
Yeah, they say it. I mean, Habermas was outspoken of this. He wrote mm-hmm. books about that. But he's very confessing very openly that this way we design to keep the church out of the politics. But anyhow, they say Islam is good for what they call it private sphere of life. Like you may have you pray all night or eat some food or not other foods. The social life, especially the governance and civil structure, should be totally secular.
Exactly.
Well, this is the second challenge. The third challenge was Islam is something Arabic or locally based. What the liberal thinking is totally mondial.
Exactly. Universal.
Universal.
Exactly.
So how you claim that? So these were debates at the beginning or before revolution and after revolution. So they translated themselves into a practical challenge. Because as I said, the Western community, with the malaise of egocentrism, they were determined to make this experiment to fail. So,
and they're still doing it today, until today.
Well, they're continuing that.
Exactly.
Well, they are doing that right now more fiercely.
Exactly.
Because they feel the threat much more strongly than the day number one. I should confess that we are children of revolution also. If it was not Imam Khomeini and scholars like Misbah Yazdi, Mutahhari, and others who were explaining in detail and giving us the light, well, we were trampling as well at the enormity of the task. But anyhow, they imposed sanction on Iran. I mean by the Americans and their allies from day number one. So the sanctions on us is 43 years old. We have from the first year condemnation resolution in the United States Board of Human Rights. These resolutions condemn us every day. Every year is not new. From the first year. And we had a lot of sabotage in our economy, in our security and the war. So you see, the challenges are quite enormous. So we survived.
And more than survived.
Well, not only we survived, we came out of this hell, I should say.
Yes.
More powerful,
exactly.
More resilient. So right now, the Western, they look at us, as you said, a very advanced society. Well, I spent most of my life, I should say, the fourth 43 years, good part of my life, in educating and promotion of science in Iran.
We should mention the place we are now.
Well,
in your
exactly.
Office.
I mean, this Institute for
exactly.
Basic Science, because it is known in the world as IPM. It is the most advanced institute in basic science in the Western of Asia, West Asia. So very well known in the world. It is a center of excellence. Papers from here, scientists from here, outside go. We have enormous projects, for example, the project in astronomy we have, project in the cyclotron project we have. I mean, a great project in Iran.
So they feel threatened when they see these things?
Well, no, when they look at us, they say that, a huge creature has been came up and quite threatening to them. Well, the issue of nuclear technology in Iran. Well, they said we are against it because Iran wants to make it atomic bomb. But this is not reality. Iran was the first country in the, Middle East and Islamic world, which had its reactors working, and which knows the whole know-how of its fuel and others. Well, right now in the southern flank of Persian Gulf, a lot of countries are building reactors, but this is turnkey built by some Siemens and others. This is quite different from our business. We know every bit of it. And it is modern. It is, I mean, you cannot say it is an old-fashioned one. So they see that this creature, which they look at us as a political creature, social creature, with the background of history that you said, we are not a new nation just came out of the earth. They say that this enormous success has a deep root in the history.
Exactly.
And when they called, read the history, they said there were great times in our country that Iranians were leading in the world. So I can feel why they are afraid. This is not justified, but because they claim to be leader of the world, they want to impose themselves on the world, they feel threatened. Otherwise, we are not harmful at all. We can live with everybody in the world.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In Britain, leaders of the tourist industry fear new entry restrictions and Britain's tarnished image among some Europeans have caused a decline in the number of visitors from the European Union. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Observer has covered this story and tells us more. French and German tourists are beginning to avoid the United Kingdom, tourism leaders fear, because of post-Brexit restrictions on travelling with identity cards. Since anti-COVID measures ended across Europe last year, tourism has started to recover, but there are growing signs that significant numbers of French and German tourists, two of the largest markets for UK tourism, are staying away from Britain. Since October of 2021, EU citizens have needed a passport to enter the United Kingdom. Previously, they could use ID cards, but less than half the population of France and Germany hold a valid passport. People who run tourist attractions and businesses in the United Kingdom say that although Americans have returned in large numbers to Britain, the French and Germans have not. Jersey's government is so concerned that last month it announced a pilot project allowing French citizens to show their ID cards on day trips to the island. This year, walking tours in Oxfordshire, a significant part of the tourist trail for foreign visitors, are seeing bookings from France and Germany at half their 2019 levels. The number of passenger vehicles transported by Le Shuttle through the Channel Tunnel in the first 2 months of 2023 dropped by 251,175 compared with 314,497 in 2019. Brittany Ferries said in December that it had 155,000 arrivals in 2022, compared with 338,000 arrivals back in 2019. The decline is not just down to the issue of passports. Brexit has also battered the perception of Britain as a welcoming nation for tourists from Europe. Data from Visit Britain and the Anhalt Ipsos Nation Brand Index shows a decline in how French and German tourists view the United Kingdom's standing compared with other countries.